1958 to 1959, a revolution had deposed the British-backed monarchy, and the government could govern, it seemed, only with the consent of the communists. They dominated the streets and could gather together crowds of up to 1 million people in a country with only 6.5 million people at the time. Imperialism was being challenged. Workers were increasingly on the offensive. An impressive array of reforms were won. And yet, by 1963, only a few short years later, the Ba'ath Party took power and thousands of communists had been exiled, tortured and killed. So a promising situation, full of possibilities, turned into a bloody defeat for the Iraqi working class. To explain how it happened, I think we really need to look at the role of the Iraqi Communist Party, the ICP, who led the mass movement. Informed by its Stalinist politics, the party tailed behind nationalist leaders and refused to pursue an independent working class policy. So this talk is going to go over what happened in the years 1958 to 1959 and the role played by the ICP. But first we need to go back a little bit and look at the background to Iraq's revolution of 1958, which is the turmoil that engulfed the Middle East in the 1940s and 1950s. So at the end of the Second World War, after the Second World War, a mass movement swept the region from Egypt to Iran, Syria to Algeria, and of course Iraq. The old colonial sponsored regimes collapsed, and their collapse wasn't just the work of handfuls of army officers, like Nasser's Free Officer Movement in Egypt, or the Free Officers in Iraq, who were the ones that that eventually took power in 1958. But rather, as British socialist Anne Alexander describes, it was also, and I'm just quoting here, the railway workers of Baghdad and the textile workers of the Egyptian Delta, students in Cairo, Alexandria and Damascus, and peasant activists in the Valley of the Nile and the hills of Kurdistan who dealt the death blow to the old order. And then she goes on. A militant trade union movement emerged, which began to challenge not only foreign capitalists in the name of the nation, but also local capitalists in the name of the working class. The industrial struggle fed back into the nationalist movement, where street protests were accompanied by massive waves of strikes. Unrest in the cities was shadowed by a gradual breakdown of social order in the countryside. Peasant movements in Syria and Egypt began to emerge towards the end of the 1940s to challenge for control of the land. Al-Nakba in 1948 further radicalised the mass movement, as people could see the unwillingness and inability of the Arab regimes to defend the Palestinians during the bloody creation of Israel. In Iraq in 1948, there was a mass urban rebellion against the old regime and the British, which became known in Arabic, and excuse my pronunciation for this and all the following Arabic words, as Al-Wathba, or the Leap. But before I describe what happened then, I just want to detour a little bit to talk about Iraqi society at this time. So 23 families controlled 56% of private, commercial and industrial capital. Land distribution was skewed heavily towards the large landowners. So in 1958, 1% of landowners owned over 55% of private land. But then on the other end of the scale, 64% of landowners had only 3.6% of cultivated land. Large parts of Iraq's economy were directly controlled by European or US capital. The oil companies were the most obvious and contentious symbols of the foreign domination of Iraq. The profits from Iraq's oil were divvied up in what was called a concessionary agreement between various foreign governments and private companies, and Iraq just got piddly royalties. And there were also similar concessionary agreements that governed transport and public utilities. A corrupt monarchy was in power, backed by British colonialism. It had very little popular support and relied heavily on repression in order to rule. Poverty was rife. Prices were increasing much faster than wages. In the 1950s, 80% of the population were illiterate. And in rural areas, life expectancy was between 35 and 39 years. The secular education system expanded, and with it, the modern lower middle class. Using classic colonial divide and rule tactics, the British ensured that the political system was dominated by Sunni Arabs, although they were a minority of Iraq's population. So there was a growth in the government bureaucracies, but middle-class Shiites and Kurds felt stifled. The Iraqi working class grew rapidly during this time. As industry developed, people moved from the countryside into the cities. The population of Baghdad doubled between 1922 and 1947. Industrial production was increasing quickly. So just as an example, from 1953 to 1958, it rose by 85%. And workers in oil production and the transport network were really crucial to the functioning of Iraqi society and so had, you know, immense power concentrated in their hands. So I think we can see underneath the surface of society discontent bubbling away and the growth in social forces that were bound to blow the lid off the pressure cooker sooner or later. The army as well wasn't walled off from the stirrings amongst ordinary people, stifled under an oppressive monarchy. So Hannah Batatu, who wrote the monumental work that's the authority on Iraq in this period, puts it like this, that the strong feelings that simmered in the depths of the people simmered also in the depths of the army. Universal conscription in the army was introduced in the 1930s and meant that all social classes and all shades of political opinion were reflected and found inside the army. A small group of army officers opposed to the monarchy started organising clandestinely from 1952, and then in 1956 the Supreme Committee of Free Officers was formed. Among their number were Abdul Karim Qasim and Abdul Salam Arif, who were to play a leading role in 1958. So I'm just going to go back to Al-Wathba, the leap. In 1948, the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty was being renegotiated at a time when industrial struggle had been rising for 2 years. So Iraq had got nominal independence from Britain in 1932, but, you know, the reality was different, and the treaty was the instrument by which Britain maintained its dominance over Iraq. And so, you know, it was just hugely unpopular. Protesters led by school and university students called for the treaty to be cancelled. They faced brutal repression. The protests went for days and then intensified when the renegotiated treaty, was signed on January 15. The protests peaked on January 20 to 21, when railway workers, led by the communists, struck and joined the protests. They were joined by factory workers, the unemployed, and peasants who had recently moved to the capital. Police shooting and even killing protesters didn't stop them. As Batatu says, the atmosphere in Baghdad was one of social revolution, and the region announced that he wouldn't ratify the treaty. Struggle continued in later months that year. In March and April 1948, it was the turn of railway workers to strike. And then in April and May of the same year, postal workers. Also in April and May, those same months, the International Petroleum Company's pumping station, K3, was paralysed by 3,000 striking clerical workers and clerical staff under communist leadership. The government tried to cut off food supplies after a few weeks to try and break the strike. So the strikers marched 250 kilometres to Baghdad, and they got food and shelter in the villages and towns along the way. And this became the stuff of legend. Batatu writes that the discontent and unrest of the 1940s became a social as well as a political issue. Anger was no longer directed against a particular government, but against the existing social order. Eventually, though, the government did regain control and instituted severe repression. In 1949, leading communists were publicly hung. Al-Wafa wasn't the first or last major challenge to the status quo. In 1920, there'd been a massive urban insurrection against the British occupation. Between 1919 and 1945, there were 7 Kurdish insurrections. In 1931, there was a 14-day strike, which turned into a protest movement against the monarchy. In 1947, there was a peasant revolt against the Sheikh landowners. And from 1952 to 1958, there were 7 more. So after the repression in the wake of Al-Wafa, struggle revived in 1952 with Iraq's own Intifada, or uprising. So as Alexander explains, student strikes over local issues quickly turned into mass demonstrations calling for direct free elections. Workers joined the protests, which retained a hard anti-imperialist edge. So workers almost always combined economic demands with the struggle for national independence. Strikes and demonstrations often concerned British firms. In 1956, there was another uprising, and in 1958, the monarchy was finally overthrown. So I just want to talk here a bit about the Communist Party, which, you know, was central. The Iraqi Communist Party was founded in the 1930s, and it was pretty much always an underground party. So after the revolution, the party could operate fairly openly, but they were actually never legalized throughout the whole period of the revolution. The ICP had strong roots in the working class, and in 1944 to 1945, when 16 trade unions were legalised, the party dominated 12 of them. Railway and port workers formed the core of the ICP's industrial organisation in the 1940s and 50s. It was also a youthful party. In 1947, 74% of its activists were under the age of 26. And this was important because it was students who gave the signal for the leap, Al-Wafa, in 1948 and the Intifada of 1952. Oppressed groups were also well represented within the party. Shiites made up the majority of people in Iraq but were oppressed. And 1955 figures showed that they made up most of the Iraqi Communist Party's rank and file, and 47% of the leadership. The ICP supported Kurdish national rights, and in many areas of Kurdistan, it actually had greater support than the nationalist Kurdish Democratic Party. And the party played a role in the peasant uprising in Arbat in 1947. The party bore the brunt of working class repression and was a party of martyrs. For instance, in 1949, during the repression in the wake of Al-Wafa, the party's general secretary, Yusuf Salman Yusuf, whose nickname was Fahd, and other communist leaders were publicly hung and their bodies left hanging for hours. The party had 1,800 members in 1947, but then declined to only 500 in 1950 due to the state repression. After the revolution in 1958, the party grew rapidly. At its peak in 1958 and 59, it had 25,000 members. Its daily newspaper sold 23,000 copies. In January 1959, the party even announced that it couldn't accept any new members because it didn't have the administrative capacity to deal with it. The ICP also dominated a number of other organisations. So some of these were the League for the Defence of Women's Rights with 25,000 members, the Iraqi Democratic Youth Federation, 84,000 members, the Partisans of Peace with 250,000 members, the General Federation of Trade Unions with 275,000 members, and the Paramilitary People's Resistance with 25,000 members. So the ICP was well organised. It had maintained a nucleus of party members during severe state repression, which then allowed it to grow rapidly during the revolution and become a mass party. But it was a Stalinist party. They had a two-stage theory of revolution. So according to this theory, you needed a bourgeois democratic revolution first, and only then could you have a socialist revolution. They saw the Iraqi revolution of 1958 as a bourgeois democratic one, and so workers taking matters into their own hands was out of the question. Flowing from this, they sucked up to nationalist leaders of various stripes and what they saw as progressive sections of the bourgeoisie. So they had a popular front approach. They allied themselves with members of the capitalist class and political currents opposed to the working class, and they subordinated workers' interests to those of their more conservative allies. The party continually propped up Qasim, the nationalist prime minister, who had no party or social base of his own. They almost never criticised him. On numerous occasions, the communists used their own resources and prestige to organise huge demonstrations which proclaimed Qasim to be the sole leader of the revolution. So this is really classical popular frontist politics, I think, of liquidating, they liquidated their own politics to those of more conservative allies. This contrasts with a possible united front approach of working with other political forces on issues that you can agree on, but actually maintaining political independence from them. The ICP in this period also looked to Russia and made sure that its strategies and tactics inside Iraq were consistent with the USSR's foreign policy aims. So, the revolution. The free officers carried out the coup which finally toppled the British-backed monarchy on the morning of July 14, 1958. They took the royal palace, assassinated the members of the royal family, and declared Iraq a republic, and virtually no shots were fired in its defence. Immediate mass demonstrations of support broke out in a number of Iraqi cities, including Baghdad, Basra, Nasiriyah, Kirkuk, and Mosul. The crowds were described as overflowing rivers, tides that engulfed, and purifying floods. 100,000 people in Baghdad tore down the statues of Emir or Prince Faisal, and also of the British General Maud, who was the so-called conqueror of Baghdad. And just behind his statue was the old British Chancellery, which was set on fire. So it was these mass protests which easily broke the back of any remaining resistance or potential resistance from the regime, the old regime supporters. 3,000 troops, only a third of them with ammunition, there is like no way they could have taken over the country without, you know, this mass support. And I think we can see the events of July 14, 1958 as the culmination of years of class struggle. So Hanna Bitatu called it the climax of a whole generation of the the climax of the struggle of a whole generation of the middle, lower middle and working classes, the culmination of an underlying, deeply embedded insurrectionary tendency of which the coup of 1936, the military movement of 1941, the Wathba of 1948, the Intifada of 1952 and the risings of 1956 were other manifestations. But if it was the climax of these struggles, it was just the beginning of the revolutionary process that was to unfold. The two leading figures to emerge from the revolution were Abdul Karim Qasim and Abdul Salam Arif. Qasim became Prime Minister after July 14. Just in terms of his background, his father was a carpenter who acquired a small farm late in life. His father was Arab Sunni and his mother Kurdish Shia. Qasim was chairman of the Supreme Committee of the Free Officers and was high up in the army before the revolution. He was the commander of an infantry brigade. His politics were nationalist, of the Iraqi nationalist variety, as opposed to the pan-Arabists who supported a union of Arab states. Qasim had no desire to attack the rich and reached out for the support of the middle class. For him, the living standards of the poor needed to be raised to a level of honourable human living without intentionally decreasing the just standard of living of the rich. Qasim never nationalised the oil industry, unlike Mossadegh in Iran in 1956. So then Arif became Deputy Prime Minister after the revolution. He was from an Arab Sunni middle class background and was, like Qasim, commander of an infantry brigade before the revolution. He was also a nationalist, but was a pan-Arabist. so supported the Union of Arab States. His rhetoric was much more left-wing than Qasim, and he did support nationalising the oil industry. Neither Qasim nor Arif had a mass base or political party of their own, although Arif did have some tribal loyalties. Throughout 1958 and 1959, rather, it was the Iraqi Communist Party and its allies who dominated the streets of major cities. And so to give a bit of a sense, on the 7th of August 1958, so a few weeks after the coup, the communists led a huge demonstration which had hundreds of thousands to up to 500,000 people. And, you know, like I said, this is a country at the time, 6.5 million people. And so the government really needed the Communist Party for its mass base. The signs of social revolution followed in the wake of the overthrow of the monarchy. So rents were cut by 20%. The price of bread dropped by a third. The eight-hour day was established. Urban labourers' wages rose by 52%. The rate of tax on the rich was increased. Industries employing over 100 workers became obliged to actually build homes for them. And the government itself built a whole town of 10,000 houses and, you know, with quite reasonable facilities for Baghdad's mud hut dwellers. Healthcare was improved and the number of places in schools and universities was increased. Workers were increasingly confident and organised and, you know, forced these reforms from Qasim's government. Unions wasted no time reorganising themselves after years of repression. So by the evening of July 14, the actual date of the Free Officers' Coup, so that evening they were already meeting, activists were meeting and reconstituting union committees. And the Iraqi Communist Party was overwhelmingly the dominant force in the trade unions. And they could take a large share of the credit for the government's reforms. So Anne Alexander describes the atmosphere among the peasantry. She says, the countryside saw a period of intensifying pressure from below combined with reform from above. Qasim limited the power of the big landowners and organised the redistribution of thousands of acres of land to the peasants. But many wanted to go further. In the towns of Kut and Amara, for instance, peasants sacked the sheikh's estates and seized the land for themselves. A key political question at the time was whether Iraq should join in the United Arab Republic, or UAR. So this was a union of Egypt and Syria, which was led by Nasser, who had nationalised the Suez Canal, famously, in 1956, and was seen as an anti-imperialist hero by millions in the Arab world. Qasim was against joining the UAR, but the Ba'ath, who were, you know, really quite small at this point, and even later, they never sort of matched the communists in terms of numbers. The Ba'ath, other nationalists and sections of the Free Officers were in favour of Iraq joining the UAR. And RF, the Deputy Prime Minister, was strongly in favour of joining the Union. RF's rhetoric, as I said, was more left-wing than Qasim, and he called for the nationalisation of the oil industry, which, you know, was still in the hands of the multinationals. But this Qasim refused to do. And the communists sided with Qasim over RF and led huge demonstrations of hundreds of thousands proclaiming Qasim to be the sole leader of the revolution and, needless to say, with no criticism of him. And this was a slogan, this sole leader slogan, the communists popularised and spread far and wide. It was a central theme in all of their public appeals. So not only did the Communist Party not expose Qasim and argue that the masses could only rely on themselves, they actually went a step further and actively and energetically sowed illusions in him. In March 1959, there was an attempted coup against the revolution in the northern city of Mosul. Mosul is an oil-rich city which had a conservative political tradition. And the coup was attempted by those supporting the Union of Iraq with the UAR. So according to Batatu, it was to a considerable degree the work of the more active stratum of the propertied class. Communist organisation in the city was very small, and so the communists adopted a strategy of mobilising their forces from around the country to go to Mosul, you know, in a show of force. So the Partisans of Peace, which was dominated by the communists, called a rally for March the 6th, and the rally was given Qasim's blessing. Qasim mobilised the governmental apparatus to get people to the rally. So he used radio and television, and they even put on a special half-price train to get people there. 250,000 people turned out that day from all over Iraq. On March the 8th, the conspirators, which with their hand forced, launched the coup in Mosul, and it had virtually no response anywhere outside that city. To defeat the coup attempt, Qasim needed the communists, and he knew it. Batatu says that he gave the communists and their tens of thousands of supporters the run of the streets in Baghdad and other towns. And even the communist-led paramilitary People's Resistance Force were given a long leash, although, as always, Qasim was careful about how much ammunition they were given. The communist-dominated organisations and unions, like the General Union of Students, the Federation of Peasants, and the League for the Defence of Women's Rights, all of these organisations leapt into action. After 3 days fighting in Mosul proper, the coup attempt was defeated. However, the ICP didn't pursue a united front to crush the reactionaries. They relinquished their political independence and merged themselves with Qasim and his supporters. And so this meant they couldn't actually use the situation to win over more of the working class to the necessity of taking power. This was actually the high watermark of communist influence during the revolution. After their successful fending off of the coup attempt, the ICP pressed Qasim for a seat in the government. On May the 1st, they mobilised hundreds of thousands of people in Baghdad around this demand of a seat for the communists in the government. But they were just refused, point blank. The moment of reckoning had arrived. Would the ICP look to the working class and challenge Qasim for power? At a meeting of the Communist Party's Politburo, it was decided to stick with Qasim. One of the major factors at play was the foreign policy of the Soviet Union. They sent an emissary to Iraq requesting that the party avoid provoking Qasim. The Russian ruling class had no desire to burn all their bridges with Nasser in Egypt or to antagonise the US unduly during the time of the so-called peaceful coexistence. The ICP followed Moscow's line. In so doing, they hung the Iraqi working class out to dry by unconditionally supporting the government that had repeatedly slapped the party and the working class in the face. Having thrown everything in with Qasim and deciding against challenging for power and firmly rejecting looking to the working class's own independent action, the party had nowhere left to turn. A minority of the leadership argued at the meeting I spoke about in favour of breaking with Qasim, but they were defeated. This was a crucial turning point in the revolution and a missed opportunity. A communist active at the time later wrote this: "We let slip through our fingers a historic opportunity and allowed a squandering of a unique revolutionary situation to the detriment of the people. Had we seized the helm and without delay armed the people, carried out a radical agrarian reform, secured the masses in their interests and their rights, granted to the Kurds their autonomy, and, by revolutionary measures, transformed the army into a democratic force, our regime would have with extraordinary speed attained to the widest popularity and would have released great mass initiatives, enabling the millions to make their own history." Really, though, I think we have to say that breaking with Qasim would have gone against the party's whole politics and history. But had there been a genuinely revolutionary party with a mass working class base in Iraq at the time, I think there's no reason why they couldn't have pushed things forward and actually led a workers' revolution. Qasim was in essence a nationalist leader who repeatedly reassured the capitalists that he had nothing against private property and who, you know, even refused to nationalise the oil. But yet the ICP wouldn't expose him for what he was. Instead, they propped him up on the demonstrations, proclaiming him as the sole leader, sucked up to him and tailed him. So what was needed wasn't, you know, giving a nationalist leader a left cover, but ruthlessly exposing him and preparing workers for the sellouts that would inevitably come. So a united front approach was needed. Yeah, cheers. So, you know, defend Qasim from attacks from the right and reactionaries, but maintain organisational and political independence from him. In May of 1959, the communist leadership had hoped to avoid conflict by backing down. But their back down did not and could not avoid conflict. What it did was simply postpone it for 4 years and weaken the only force that could defend and extend the revolution, the working class. 4 years later, the revolution was drowned in blood by the Baathists. On the 4th of February 1963, the Ba'ath Party launched a coup. People poured onto the streets of Baghdad to defend the government and begged Qasim for arms, but were knocked back. Qasim was executed, and from February to November 1963, Iraq saw what academics Marion Faruk Sluglett and Peter Sluglett describe as the most terrible scenes of violence hitherto experienced in the Middle East. Rank-and-file members and supporters of the ICP were rounded up in their homes or shot in the street. Faruk Sluglett and Sluglett describe how many thousands were arrested and sports grounds were turned into makeshift prisons to hold the flood of detainees. People were killed in the streets, tortured to death in prison, or executed after mock trials. But by the time of the decision not to break with Qasim in 1959, the die was cast. In those four years between 1959 and 1963, the ICP's influence massively declined. A few months after the communists saved the government from the Mosul coup attempt, the government showed its thanks by repressing them. They arrested hundreds of communists. Communist publications were outlawed at various places at various times. The party's youth organisation was disbanded by the police and 200 of its leaders arrested. And throughout the whole period of the revolution, despite the party's central role, amazingly, it was never legalised. But so by refusing to break with Qasim, the Communist Party really laid the basis for what was to come. Because they wouldn't push the revolution beyond the boundaries set by Qasim, they made both Qasim's downfall and their own inevitable. So as Anne Alexander argues, broadening the struggle beyond the limits set by nationalism would have deepened and strengthened the mass movement. The communists in Iraq found that while the revolution remained within those limits, it could neither preserve its democratic character nor offer effective resistance to imperialism. So the choice was never between a nice democratic constitutional republic on the one hand and civil war on the other, as the communists argued, but rather between workers' power and between an authoritarian nightmare under the Baathists. Iraqi's communists certainly didn't lack organisation or courage and bravery, but they did lack the right politics. Their Stalinism, in the end, held back a revolution pregnant with possibility and paved the way for bloody Baathist rule. But Iraq's revolution shows us that when workers in the Middle East take action, they challenge not only their own rulers, but also imperialism. In the years of 1958 to 1959, and you know the decades preceding it, the Iraqi working class provide us with a glimpse of that. Then, as now, it is the Iraqi working class that needs to rise up, and when they do, they'll be following in a long and proud history of working class struggle and anti-imperialist revolts in their country.